probably strike again. All they could do was wait. Wait for a mistake. Or wait for another rape. The calculations had changed. The math was not so simple. Who was this guy? Chapter 5. A Losing Battle. Camp Casey, Dongducheon, South Korea. He could remember the moment the monster was born. It was embarrassing, really, to tell people. He was 5 years old. His parents took him to see Star Wars, Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. Early in the film, there is a scene in the den of Jabba the Hutt, the interplanetary gangster who has the hero pilot Han Solo imprisoned in a frozen block. Jabba, an enormous sybaritic grub, looms on a platform, surrounded by slaves, halflings and aliens. Exotic music wails. The boy and his parents watched Luke Skywalker, mysterious and hooded, sneak into the lair while Jabba slept. There, lying at the base of the platform, is Princess Leia. She is bared, almost naked, in a metallic bikini, revealing her thighs, her stomach, her throat. She is attached to Jabba by a chain, a metal collar around her neck. She starts awake as Luke walks in and jerks uselessly at the chain. She is Jabba's slave. He would recall that moment often in his later years. At the time, he did not have the words to even describe what he felt. It was alive. It was electric. It was dangerous. It filled him with pleasure. He knew only that he wanted to have that kind of control over a woman, to totally possess and to own her. He described himself as like a young animal, bonding to the first creature it sees. He had imprinted on fear, on humiliation, on enslavement. From then on, I was basically ready to tie up every girl on the block, was how he remembered it. As he got older, the thrill of the forbidden deepened. When he was 8, he broke into a house with some of his friends and stole cash. It was exciting, being where he wasn't supposed to be. He started breaking into homes just because he could. How many times? He lost track. It was just him having fun. Something about it, even the act of cracking a window or opening a door, not even stepping in, was just an adrenaline rush, he'd say. He didn't talk about his obsessions with anyone. Who would understand? His family life was normal enough. I've had a lot of love in my life, he'd say. He grew up in Tennessee, the oldest of 3 siblings. His mother and father divorced, but mom remarried, and the new family moved to Longmont, Colorado, a rural town an hour outside of Denver. With a population of about 80,000, it was surrounded by farmland, flat fields of corn and alfalfa stretching in every direction. In the background rose the jagged height of Long's Peak, the town's namesake, and, at 14,259 feet, the most northern of the soaring heights in the Rockies, known as Fourteeners. There, he learned to live 2 lives. The side that faced the world was fun, gentle. He was a kid with spiky hair and a big toothy grin who loved cats, rollerbladed, and doted on a ferret named Elvis, who lived in a habitat that he named Graceland. He picked up the guitar, began playing, and got good. He mastered Little Wing, the enigmatic tone poem by Jimi Hendrix. He would play it for his mother to song's end, to where a woman, with 1,000 smiles, promises relief from some inner turmoil. "It's all right," she says. "It's all right. Take anything you want from me. Anything." The other side was that turmoil. Internal, dark, confused. He knew that his fantasies about women were sick, pathological, wrong. He knew that voyeurism, That illicit intrusion into the lives of others that he so enjoyed was abnormal. But, he told himself, these were just thoughts in his head. He could keep them under control. He could keep himself under control. It's just in my head. My business and no one else's, he'd tell himself. He switched schools when he was a sophomore and began attending Old Columbine High School. It was a low, flat building on the southern end of town, surrounded by an auto parts store, fast food restaurants, and a mall. He hung out with a small group of friends. On weekends, they would drive out of town, down the long, flat highways that laced the long, flat landscape. They would drink beers by the side of the road. Once, when he was 16, he and four buddies were arrested by a Boulder County Sheriff's deputy during a sting on underage drinking called Kegger Interdiction. It was 1:30 a.m. on a Saturday. He had 16 bottles of beer in the back of his car. He paid an $80 fine. He graduated from Old Columbine on May 31, 1995. He moved to Denver and rented a room with a high school friend near Cherry Creek, a posh nightlife district. He worked for a year as a sales rep for one internet company, then for another year as a tech support guy who would go to people's homes and set up their internet service. He shot pool with his buddies. He got busted for smoking marijuana, but the prosecutor dropped the charges. He enrolled in the University of Denver, but left after a semester. He moved back in with his parents in Longmont and tended bar at Oscar Blues in nearby Lyons, Colorado, a dark, earthy bar famous on the local brew pub scene. 6 years had passed since he graduated from high school. He still wasn't sure what he wanted to do. Then 9/11 happened. He considered himself a pacifist. He kept his hair long, hippie long, rock star long. He liked hanging out in Boulder, a lefty outpost in mostly conservative Colorado. He thought people in the military were knuckle-draggers, rednecks, brainwashed. But when he saw the Twin Towers crumple, something stirred in him. He found a calling, a mission that could distract him from the monster. He walked into the United States Army recruiting station in downtown Denver on January 22, 2002, 3 months after the United States invaded Afghanistan. At 23, he was a little older than the average Army recruit. He could do 13 push-ups and 17 sit-ups and could run the mile in 8 minutes and 30 seconds. He was 6 feet 2, but weighed just 155 pounds. It worried the recruiter. The guy would blow over in a strong wind. "You can't afford to lose a single pound before basic training," the sergeant warned. He had a hard time believing that he was entering the armed forces of the United States of America. "I was not exactly the military type," he would write. He stunned his parents, too. "We laughed and thought he was kidding," his mother says. He really felt in his heart that, you know, he had to go fight and defend what had happened to our country and our people. He wanted us to be safe. He was not sure whether he would fit in. Some Army recruiters divide soldiers into alphas and bravos depending on their scores on the military's entrance exam, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Bravos score lower, but they're considered better soldiers. They tend to be pliable, willing to follow orders. They rise easily through the ranks. Big Army values obedience over brains. Alphas score higher on the test. They tend to be independent thinkers. But that means they're also more likely to question authority. They can be seen as outsiders, rebels. He was an alpha. His scores put him in the very top echelon of test takers. He only had a high school diploma, but he qualified for entry into the military's most intellectually and mentally challenging jobs. He had potential to become a geospatial engineer, a criminal investigator, an expert in cryptology, the kind of jobs that usually went to officers and college graduates. Instead, he signed up to become an infantryman, a grunt, the most atomic unit of the United States military. In 2002 in Afghanistan, the infantry were the guys marching through muddy mountain villages, knocking down doors, and shooting to kill. They were the ones driving across dusty highways in unarmored Humvees, squeezing their butt cheeks together in hopes that a roadside bomb wouldn't send a shank of metal hurtling into their guts. They were the tip of the spear. But instead of hunting Taliban, he was assigned to Camp Casey, South Korea, a 3,500-acre base 10 miles south of the demilitarized frontier with North Korea. His new home was also surrounded by mountains. Now, though, the tallest peak in sight was Mount Gumgang, 5,374 feet high. He was assigned to Company D, 2nd Battalion of the Army's 9th Infantry Regiment, the Manchus. Their name derived from the unit's legendary courage under fire during the Boxer Rebellion. He had never been out of the country before. The pacifist distinguished himself as a military man. He quit smoking. He gained weight and added muscle. He excelled in training exercises and learned military tactics. Before a mission, he would do reconnaissance to scope out a target. Before attacking, he would conduct pre-combat inspections, or PCIs, to make sure that he had his gear at hand and his weapon ready. The Army recognized his work with the usual awards. He was accepted into a special honor guard. He earned medals for good conduct, Army achievement, and service to the national defense. He was recognized for his skill with weapons. He proved himself especially lethal with the M249, a light machine gun, once taking out an opposing infantry team sneaking toward his platoon's outpost during a training exercise. His maturity has been a contribution in the action of his peers and off-duty, one superior wrote. He advanced from private first class to sergeant. He had transformed into a knuckle-dragger. He described himself as a pretty good soldier. He wrote his mother frequently, telling her how much he enjoyed his job. He was in charge of training soldiers in South Korea's 2nd Infantry Division who were headed out to Afghanistan and Iraq. His mother thought he was becoming a better person. He wanted to train those guys as best he could to help them survive, because he knew that some of them would not be returning back to their homes, she said. We really just saw a huge change in him then, for the good. In October 2003, he met a Russian cocktail waitress at a bar near base. Masha, a pseudonym, spoke English with a hint of an accent. She had short hair and high bangs. Her face was broad and friendly, her lips full. She kept her nails manicured. She was 3 years younger. As a foreign national, Masha was not allowed to live on the military base, so each day he would leave the camp at 4 p.m., stay with her until the midnight curfew, then race back to base. After 6 months of dating, they married on March 11, 2004. He transferred to a base in Seoul, and they moved in together. They had a typical Army marriage. They hung out with friends, mostly fellow soldiers with their own young wives and girlfriends. They drank at bars at night. They partied at apartments on base. Sometimes they hiked. He told his new wife nothing of his dark side. He continued to be haunted by images of sexual sadism, women in chains, women subjugated, women terrified as he raped them. He did not ask Masha to fulfill those fantasies. He once filmed them having sex, but she didn't like it, and he never tried again. He didn't even ask to tie her up. He considered their sex life normal, even vanilla. He had a hard time projecting his lust onto women he actually knew, women he liked. It was easier if the women were anonymous, distant. He had kept his imagination at heel all through his teens and early 20s. The images would rise, and then, over time, fade. He would feel normal again. But now, they began to dominate his thoughts, a kind of incessant mental tinnitus. He was constantly fighting his obsessions. It exhausted him, mentally and physically. I coped the only way I knew how, which was to not tell anybody and to try to control it in my head. He sought relief away from Masha. He started looking at increasingly violent pornography. He tried going to prostitutes, asking them to play rape victims. Nothing worked to calm him. He was beginning to lose control. He would think about his dilemma and blame it on his reaction to Star Wars. Where do you go when you're 5 and you're already thinking about handcuffs? He thought. He began to wonder, what if I acted on my desires? How would that change things? Perhaps if he indulged himself one time, he would be at peace. I convinced myself that if I just did it once, then it'd be like an itch that I had scratched, and that I could basically get over it and move on with my life, he'd say. What he needed, what the monster needed, was fear. Real fear. He decided to attack. Outside the high walls of many American bases in South Korea lie districts of narrow, garishly lit streets lined with shoebox nightclubs. The most notorious of these clubs are called juicy bars, where soldiers buy a $10 glass of juice and quality time with a young Filipina drinky girl. At night, the girls flood the streets and side alleys in tight dresses and high heels, unabashed and unafraid. Perfect targets, he thought. He began following women at night through the packed streets and labyrinthine byways. He had a mask and gloves, but not much of a plan. He figured he would kidnap a girl, take her someplace, a hotel room, a car parked in the woods, who knew? He'd rape her, and at last he'd be cured. He wasn't worried about the risk. What happens in Korea stays in Korea, he told himself. But it was not as easy as he thought. For months, he tailed girls deep into the night. Each time, after hours in the streets, he'd call it off. At home, his emotions surged, an angry, poisonous sea. He was simultaneously afraid of carrying out his plans and disgusted at his inability to act. But he didn't tell anyone. He always had a story for Masha. He was hanging out with friends. He had to work late. She never suspected anything. And then, one night, it happened. It was near midnight. He saw a young Korean woman, about his age, wobbling down an alley. She was alone. She looked very, very drunk. Fuck it, he told himself. I just can't sit out here on the fucking street my whole life. He was in peak shape, 180 pounds, conditioned and muscled. He jumped on the woman and threw her to the ground. She struggled, fighting him back. Screaming in English with a strong accent, she focused on the dark clothes he wore. Get off me, black guy! Go away, black guy! He burst out laughing. Here was this tiny, drunk girl, and she was trying to fight him off. It was comical. Where was the fear? The terror? Okay, this is not what I expected, he thought. He pushed himself away. She got to her feet, stood unsteadily, and began to stagger away. She did not run. She walked. He followed behind her for a few steps, laughing. She faced him again. She picked up a rock from the street and threw it at him. Go away, black guy! She screamed again. It was loud enough that he started to worry that she was attracting attention. He decided to call it off. Again. He was disappointed, confused. The whole thing had been ridiculous. It was theater of the absurd. He had learned his lesson. Grabbing someone in an alley isn't for me. It's not going to work, he said to himself. The next time, he combined his plan to rape with his childhood thrill, breaking into a house. He went on the hunt again, this time through residential neighborhoods. One night, he saw his opportunity. It was a small ground-floor apartment. The windows were uncovered. He could see everything inside. The kitchen, a small bathroom, and the bedroom. It thrilled him. It was like looking into a dollhouse, each room displayed for his pleasure. In the bed, a woman was sleeping. It was 3 a.m. No one else was around. He glanced at the door, where Koreans leave their shoes upon entering their homes. He saw only women's footwear. If any men lived in a home, they were out, he thought. He tried the door handle. It was unlocked. This was his chance. He put on a ski mask and gloves and slipped inside. He stopped and looked around. The apartment was tiny. In the kitchen, he saw packages of MREs, the ready-to-eat meals that the army issues to soldiers in the field. He suddenly worried that the woman was married to an American. He looked around, but saw no other signs of a Westerner's presence. He calmed down. The path to fulfilling his fantasy was clear at last. As he stood in the kitchen, the angry sea surged again. He was paralyzed, trying to talk himself into the attack and trying to talk himself out of it. A half hour passed in the strange apartment with the strange woman just lying in bed, feet from him. What the fuck are you doing? He asked himself. You know, just walk out of here and forget this whole thing. All of a sudden, he heard a noise outside. He exited the kitchen just as an older Korean man flung open the front door. The Korean, unsteady on his feet after a late night at the bar, looked up. A beefy intruder, 6 feet easy, with hazel eyes framed by a black mask, loomed above him, standing in the middle of his home in the middle of the night. The startled homeowner bolted back outside, slamming the front door shut. Shit, he thought. I'm trapped. He lunged to push the door open and escape, but the Korean man was on the other side, pressing his weight into the door. I'm going to get locked in, he thought. Oh, fuck! I'm going to get locked in here! But the next second, the door flung outward. The Korean man had yanked it open. He was standing to one side, like a doorman at a hotel. He needed no such courtesies. He broke past the Korean man into the street. He sprinted at top speed, flying past houses, through the darkened city, until he reached his home about a mile away. He was gasping. The blood in his veins felt like battery acid. He had almost been caught. He had been an idiot. He had been the one afraid. I can't be making stupid mistakes like that, and I definitely can't be impulsive about it, he told himself. If you don't plan to go to jail, you need to think this through a little bit more. His enlistment was ending soon. He looked forward to going home, back to the United States. He could practice there. Chapter 6. White Man, Blue Eyes, Gray Sweater. Monday, August 11th, 2008. Linwood, Washington. The 911 call came in at 7:55 a.m., the caller's words leaving no doubt of the urgency. A young woman said her downstairs neighbor had just been raped inside her apartment. The attacker had fled maybe 15 minutes ago. The dispatcher kept the neighbor on the line, taking in a flurry of details passed along from the victim. The rapist had a knife. He took pictures. The victim didn't recognize him. He may have been in the apartment all night because he heard a phone conversation she'd been having. At 8:03, the caller reported that the victim had just found the knife in her bedroom. At 8:04, that the victim's mom had just arrived. The apartment complex was about a mile from police headquarters, reachable with a couple of turns. As the dispatcher listened, they were already routing police to the scene, with officers arriving at 8:03, 8:04, 8:05. An ambulance was called. So was a canine unit, in hopes a dog could pick up the attacker's track. Crime scene technician Ann Miles was the officer who arrived at 8:04, the second on the scene. She pulled up to the complex and made her way to the victim's first-floor apartment. Inside, she found an 18-year-old with wavy hair and hazel eyes and asked her what had happened. This would be Marie's first time telling an officer what took place that morning. But important as the moment was, Marie's memory would erase it. She would remember shaking in a blanket in the corner as police arrived. She would remember talking to the ambulance crew. She would remember moving to the couch and sitting next to Peggy. But she would not remember a woman officer being there, detailed as her account to the officer was. Marie told Miles that she had awakened to a man with a knife. He pulled away her comforter and sheet and told her to roll over on her stomach. He straddled her, bound her, blindfolded her, gagged her, then ordered her to roll back over. He groped and raped her. It felt like he was wearing gloves. He told her he had worn a condom. She heard clicking and saw some sort of flash. He told her he had taken photographs and would post them online if she went to police. Then he left, through the front door. She heard it shut. Miles asked Marie if she could describe the man. Marie said she didn't get a good look. Everything had happened so fast. All she could say was he was white. His eyes were blue. His sweater was gray. Miles asked if anything stood out about his voice or smell or anything else, and Marie told Miles again, everything had happened so fast. It was all a blur. Miles asked how long the attack lasted. Marie said she had no idea. Marie told Miles that the rapist had dumped her purse out on the floor. She didn't know why. Miles' job was to collect and process physical evidence, so with Marie, she began walking the apartment. In the bedroom, she saw Marie's purse on the floor and wallet on the bed. The wallet was missing Marie's learner's permit. Miles spotted it on the ledge of the bedroom window. Next to Marie's bed, on top of a plastic storage bin, Miles saw a large knife with a black handle. Marie told Miles that the knife was from her kitchen and was the one the rapist had threatened her with. On top of the bed, Miles saw a shoestring, used, apparently, to tie up Marie. In the bedroom corner, on top of a computer monitor, Miles found a second shoestring, threaded through a pair of women's underwear. The string tied to the underwear was either used as the blindfold or was placed in Marie's mouth so she couldn't scream. Miles would write in a report. Marie told Miles that the laces came from her own tennis shoes out in the living room. Miles asked if Marie had locked up the night before. Marie said she wasn't sure. Miles checked the front door and saw no sign of it being forced open. Then she checked the sliding glass door at the rear of the apartment. It was unlocked and slightly ajar. Miles stepped outside to the back porch and inspected the wood railing. Most of it was covered with dirt, but there was one stretch, about 3 feet wide, that appeared to have been brushed off, perhaps by someone climbing over. Miles searched for traces of DNA on the sliding glass door, swabbing the inside and outside handles. She photographed the apartment inside and out. She took at least 70 shots, capturing the details that might illuminate what had happened that morning. The porch railing, the learner's permit on the bedroom window ledge, a knife block in the kitchen with one knife missing, the shoes without laces. The shoes were next to the living room sofa. On top of the sofa, leaning against the wall, were a couple of stuffed animals, a spotted cow, and a dog with white paws. After leaving Marie's apartment, Miles wrote up a 2-page report, a simple recitation of the steps she had taken. Her report gave no hint of what she believed or didn't believe. It kept to what she had seen and done. The Linwood Police Department had 79 sworn officers, serving a city of about 34,000 people. In 2008, Marie's was one of 10 reports of rape the department investigated. With so few cases, the Criminal Investigations Division didn't have a separate sex crimes unit. On the morning Marie reported being raped, the head of the division, Commander James Nelson, came to the apartment building and pitched in, going door to door to interview potential witnesses. The man in 203 said he hadn't heard or seen anything unusual. He was the only resident Nelson managed to talk to. At apartments 103, 201, 301, 302, 303, and 304, nobody answered the door. Nelson also tried another apartment building nearby. He interviewed 3 residents and noted the same response from each. Did not see or hear anything suspicious. Nelson got no answer at 7 other apartments. At about 8:15, the canine unit showed up. The dog tracked to the south towards an office building, however, it didn't lead to anything, the officer reported. The dog also failed to pick up anything to the north, around a parking area. Later in the morning, a second crime scene technician arrived to help. Like Miles, Detective Josh Kelsey wrote a 2-page report. Unlike Miles, he wrote his 11 days later, well after Marie had recanted. Kelsey did a walkthrough and, in his report, recorded his observations. The shoes with the missing laces were lying next to each other near the end of the couch and the bedroom door, on the soles as if placed there, not disturbed. The bed appeared disturbed, but there was a small fan sitting upright at the head of the bed next to the 2 pillows. I did not see any item that would have been used as the blindfold. Kelsey dusted the sliding door for fingerprints. From the inside glass, he managed to lift some partials, which he preserved on a fingerprint card. Although Marie had said the rapist left through the front door, Kelsey made no note of inspecting that door for possible prints or DNA. Neither had Miles during her earlier canvas. Kelsey inspected the bedroom with an alternate light source, searching for the characteristic glow of body fluids. He didn't spy anything on the comforter or blankets piled on the floor, but he did see 2 spots on the mattress. On the bed, he also saw a couple of hair follicles and some fibers, which he collected. In all, Kelsey gathered and labeled 18 items of evidence, removing from Marie's apartment the physical exhibits of her young life, bagging every layer of bedding from pink comforter down to mattress pad, bagging her shoes, wallet, and learner's permit. Sergeant Jeffrey Mason, a Linwood police detective, arrived at about 8:45. Outside the apartment were Marie's Project Ladder case manager, Wayne, and her upstairs neighbor. Inside, Marie sat on the couch with her foster mother, Peggy. Marie was wrapped in a blanket. She cried off and on. This investigation would be Mason's to lead. He walked over to Marie and introduced himself. Mason was 39 years old. He had been promoted to sergeant and transferred to the Criminal Investigations Division just 6 weeks before. He had spent most of his career in Oregon, where he had begun as a dispatcher for Wasco County and worked his way up to the Oregon State Police. His longest stint was with a small police department in a town called The Dalles, where he served for almost 9 years and received a Medal of Valor. Over the years, he had taken dozens of training courses on all kinds of subjects. He'd gone to sniper school. He'd studied outlaw motorcycle gangs. He'd learned to interrogate suspects and interpret their body language for tells. But there was one subject he knew best, as attested to by the instructional programs listed in his personnel file. Indoor marijuana grows, street drugs, poly-testing, narcotics screening and identification, reconnaissance and interdiction detachment, RAID for short, hidden compartments, Mexican meth. His courses ranged from aerial spotting, how to spy a pot patch amid other vegetation from hundreds of feet in the sky, to how to keep safe when moving in on a clandestine drug lab. His was a world of undercover buys and informants in which officers navigated among drug users and dealers. Mason joined Linwood's police department in 2003. Before his recent promotion, he had spent 4 years in patrol and a year as a narcotics detective, earning praise for his dedication and dependability. Superiors appreciated his professionalism, from the quality of his written reports, thorough and well thought out with few to no mistakes, to his approach to police work, proactive, to his leadership, an innate ability to mentor. "Excellent work habits," wrote one sergeant, who commended Mason's ability to work with minimal supervision. In his 19 years in law enforcement, Mason had worked only one or two rape cases. He had received some sexual assault training, but it had been long ago, in the mid-1990s. When the two met, Marie struck Mason as forthright. "I didn't have a lot of experience dealing with sexual assault victims," he would say later. "But I didn't go in with an expectation of how she might be acting. She wasn't hysterical. She was very matter-of-fact. This is what occurred." Speaking with Mason and a second detective, Marie covered much of the same ground she had gone over with Miles. The unlocked sliding door, the stranger with a knife, the rape in her bedroom. Mason told Marie he would need more details later, but for now, she needed to go to the hospital for a sexual assault examination. After that, he wanted her to come to the police station to give a full statement. After Marie left, accompanied by her case manager and foster mom, Mason walked the apartment, taking in the emptied purse, the underwear laced with a shoestring, the mattress, askew, about 4 inches out of line with the box spring. Mason also talked to Natalie, the 18-year-old neighbor who lived directly above Marie. Natalie said she hadn't heard anything unusual during the night. Then, in the morning, at 7:52, maybe 7:53, she got a call from Marie, screaming, crying, saying someone had broken into her place and raped her. Natalie grabbed her cell phone, ran down the stairs, and called 911 from Marie's apartment. Although Mason was the lead investigator on the case, he would receive help from Jerry Ritgarn, another member of the Criminal Investigations Division. Ritgarn had a bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of Washington. He had previously served in the Marine Corps, specializing in helicopter avionics, and worked as a technician in the aerospace industry. He had been with the Linwood Police for 11 years, the last 4 as a detective. One of his duties, backgrounding job candidates and recommending whether they be hired, testified to the department's faith in his investigative abilities. In 2006, he had been named Linwood's Officer of the Year. As was the case for other detectives called to the apartment complex, Ritgarn wrote up his report days later, after Marie had taken back her story. His report said he had looked at Marie's wrists before she left for the hospital, and he hadn't noticed markings on either. When Marie's bedroom was examined with ultraviolet light, he didn't see liquid stains on the sheet or bedding. He searched the apartment, bathroom, toilet, trash cans throughout, for a condom or wrapper, but found neither. He also looked outside, walking the side of a hill, to no avail. Peggy and Wayne took Marie to Providence Regional Medical Center in nearby Everett. Providence had a center for sexual assault with victims' advocates and nurses specially trained in collecting evidence. By August of 2008, the specialized examination of rape victims, often referred to as rape kits for the box in which the evidence is placed, had been around for 30 years. They originated by virtue of a victim's advocate, a police microanalyst, and funding from a most unlikely source. In the mid-1970s, Martha Marty Goddard formed a nonprofit in Chicago called the Citizens Committee for Victim Assistance. At the time, rape, steeped in stigma, received little attention. What attention it did get often did more damage than good. Goddard, a self-described type A personality, she lived close to the office, worked weekends and holidays, spent hundreds of dollars on a gym membership but never escaped work long enough to go in the door, set out to change that. Part of her challenge was confronting how people wrote about rape. One of her board members picked up a greeting card in a store, brought it into Goddard, and, freaking out, said, "Read this." "Help stop rape," the card's cover said. The note inside was, "Say yes." Goddard wrote the card company with her own message, "You guys, I'm sure, think it's funny, but it's not funny." The company, chagrined, pulled the card from shelves. Goddard saw a newspaper story in Chicago about a woman who had reported being raped. The story may not have named her, but with its careless cascading of detail, combining precise physical description with her job, waitress, and the place she worked, the exact restaurant, it hardly needed to. Identifying her would be easy enough. Goddard went to the newspaper and met with an editor and some of his staff. At first they were defensive, then they apologized. "And I gotta tell you, they never did it again," Goddard says. For Goddard, such were her days. One incident by one incident by one incident. It took forever. Goddard also focused on the enforcement of sexual assault laws. She met with police, prosecutors, and emergency room doctors and nurses, and discovered a problem in how rape was investigated. The collection of physical evidence was haphazard. If hairs, fibers, blood, semen, fingernail scrapings, clothing, and other evidence were gathered at all, they were often preserved or labeled improperly, jeopardizing their value. Police told Goddard of emergency room workers rubber banding two slides together, face to face, contaminating both samples. Sometimes slides wouldn't say where the samples came from. The ER workers were trained to see a rape victim as a patient, not as a patient and a crime scene. Often, hospitals didn't have replacement clothes available. Victims, their clothes seized as evidence, might be taken home in a marked police car and emerge wearing hospital slippers and patient gown tied in the back. Their neighbors were sure to wonder. At the Chicago Police Department, Goddard found allies for her cause, most notably Sergeant Lou Vitullo, a microanalyst who was head of the crime lab. Vitullo worked downtown, but lived an hour north of the city. Chicago made him nervous. He didn't let his daughter go there alone until her 20s, which stood to reason, what with the blood and knives coming through his lab. In the 60s, he'd worked on the investigation of Richard Speck, the infamous murderer of 8 student nurses. Working with Goddard, the crime lab eventually became my second home. I'm not kidding you, she says. Vitullo devised a blue and white cardboard box that standardized the collection of evidence in sexual assault cases. The kit itemized swabs and slides to be gathered and provided labeled folders to be filled and sealed. So with Vitullo's help, Goddard had a design. What she lacked was the money for parts and assembly. Foundations gave generously to medical research hospitals and symphonies. If they chose to fund women's and girls' programs, they might give to the YWCA or Girl Scouts. But they wanted nothing to do with the subject of rape. Most of the foundation and corporate people were male, Goddard says. And they held the big money, so they held the purse strings, and it wasn't loosening up. Ultimately, Goddard turned to a friend, Margaret Standish. Standish ran the Playboy Foundation, the activist arm of Hugh Hefner's publishing empire. The Playboy Foundation provided $10,000 and the use of Playboy's offices as an assembly line, where volunteers, mostly senior citizens, were provided with fold-out tables and free coffee and sandwiches while building the first of these revolutionary kits. I took a lot of flack from the women's movement, but too bad, Goddard says. If it was Penthouse or Hustler, no. But Playboy, please, give me a break. In September of 1978, 26 hospitals in the Chicago area began using the kits. The following year, 2,777 kits went to the Chicago Crime Lab for analysis. In the summer of 1979, prosecutors used one while trying a man accused of raping a Chicago Transit Authority bus driver. The jury voted to convict, after which the judge let Goddard's committee ask jurors if the kit helped them reach a verdict. 9 said it did. That same year, Goddard met a Northwestern University graduate, Susan Erian, who worked in public relations while volunteering with a fledgling group called Rape Victim Advocates. Erian was on call for 12-hour shifts, during which she could be paged by any of 7 emergency rooms to help guide sexual assault victims through medical exams and police interviews. Goddard hired Erian to be assistant director for the Citizens Committee for Victim Assistance. For 2.5 years, Erian trained hospital workers and police in use of the rape kits and in the complexities of trauma. Don't be hostage to your expectations, she would teach. Sometimes, trauma doesn't look the way you think it should. For expertise, Erian turned to John Conti, a social work professor in Chicago who would later move on to the University of Washington and evaluate Marie. Erian also incorporated the lessons in Rape, Crisis, and Recovery, a book published in 1979 by a psychiatric nurse and a sociologist who had provided crisis intervention services for 146 rape victims admitted to Boston City Hospital. The authors discovered a range of emotional reactions among rape victims. Some were angry or anxious, some composed, some in shock. I remember doing some strange things after he left, such as biting my arm, to prove I could feel that I was real, one woman reported. Physical reactions included disrupted sleep patterns and lingering pain. I am so sore under my ribs, said another victim. The pain just stays there. It doesn't go away. I guess he really hurt me, although the X-ray didn't show anything. Some victims suffered nightmares, their dreams similar to the rape itself, the victim unable to get away. Some underwent a form of self-imposed isolation, rarely venturing out, missing school, or quitting work. By 1980, 215 hospitals in Illinois were using Goddard and Vitullo's rape kits. From there, they became standard issue across the country. The advent of DNA testing in the late 1980s made the kits especially powerful. By pushing forensic science beyond the limitations of blood typing and microscopy. But valuable as the evidence can be, the collection process, lasting 3 to 6 hours, exacts a toll. At Providence, Marie was joined by Jana, the supervisor with Project Ladder. Jana stayed with Marie during the exam to help keep her calm. She rubbed Marie's back. She told Marie this wasn't her fault. The medical team included a nurse who had received special training in these examinations and was in a position to relate, having suffered sexual abuse herself. A victim's advocate also stayed throughout to provide psychological support and answer any of Marie's questions. A medical report described Marie as alert and oriented, and in no acute distress. A doctor evaluated Marie as the nurse assisted with all that was required. They asked Marie to describe the assault. They drew Marie's blood. They took a urine sample. They collected vaginal discharge and smeared it on a slide. They tested Marie for gonorrhea. They tested her for hepatitis and chlamydia and syphilis. They tested her for yeast infection. They tested her for HIV. In each case, Marie was told that the test results would not be available until later. She would have to wait to know. The team's exam also included forensic work to assist in any criminal investigation. They collected each item of Marie's clothing to be inspected later in a crime lab. They examined Marie, looking for signs of injury. Where injury was noted, they documented it. Trauma noted to wrists bilaterally, they wrote in a report. They photographed her wrists and measured the abrasions, length and width, to tenths or even hundredths of a centimeter. The longest abrasion, red and raised, was 7 centimeters, or 2¾ inches. While searching for genital injury, they applied toluidine blue, a staining dye that creates contrast between healthy and injured tissue. Abrasions to inner aspect labia minora, they wrote in the report. They swabbed the inside of Marie's cheek to collect DNA. Forensic scientists would need Marie's genetic profile to distinguish it from any other DNA profiles that might turn up in the swabs collected in the rape kit. They collected 4 vaginal swabs. They collected 4 rectal swabs. They collected 4 swabs from the area in between. The swabs were placed in a drying box, then secured with other evidence in a locker, pending release to the Linwood police. They treated Marie for possible exposure to sexually transmitted diseases, giving her 1 gram of Zithromax and 400 milligrams of Suprax. They provided her with emergency contraception, having her take 1 pill then at the hospital and giving her a 2nd pill to take 12 hours later. They asked her to let them know if she experienced excessive bleeding, or unusual vaginal discharge, or if she stopped menstruating. They advised her to return to the emergency room if she experienced shortness of breath, or had trouble swallowing, or suffered hives, or thought of killing herself. Peggy had stayed at the hospital with Marie after driving her there. She watched as they photographed Marie's wrists. She held Marie's hand. But the exam wound up taking so long that Peggy left. She now had 2 other foster children, both teenage girls, and after 3 hours or so, she went home to take care of them. After the exam, Marie changed into a new set of clothes she had brought with her to the hospital. By the time she left Providence, morning had turned to afternoon. By 2008, when Marie reported being raped, sex crime specialists had developed investigative protocols with one dominant theme: evidence trumps assumptions. The year before, End Violence Against Women International, a nonprofit organization that trains police, produced a comprehensive online course on investigating rape. One of its lead creators was Joanne Archambault, a retired police sergeant who, for 10 years, had supervised the San Diego Police Department's Sex Crimes Unit. Archambault had built her career in policing on challenging assumptions. In the late 1970s, she was working at the Educational Cultural Complex in San Diego, helping others find employment. Two police recruiters told Archambault that only men were fit for police work. "They pissed me off," Archambault says, "so much so that she applied herself. I never planned to be a cop. I just planned to show them I could be hired." Her training group at the police academy included 120 recruits. Only 4 were women. To Archambault, the training seemed geared toward weeding women out. The pull-up bar, for example, was too thick for most women's hands. Within a year, Archambault was the only woman left. She was hired by the San Diego Police Department in the spring of 1980, and after a stint as a patrol officer, worked in a half dozen other units, at one point becoming the department's first female gang detective. For Archambault, her 23 years as a cop became a study in the prevalence and corrosiveness of doubt. While investigating child abuse cases, she was stunned at how many mothers did not believe their kids. After joining the sex crimes unit, she bristled at the advice she remembered seeing in a 1995 article published by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. "Generally, the actions and the appearance of a legitimate rape victim leave little doubt that a crime has been committed. Under such circumstances, the victim is highly agitated, emotionally distraught, often in a state of hysteria, and may have sustained injuries, cuts, bruises, or wounds. The victim's clothing is often ripped or torn off as evidence that it was forcibly removed, and if the rape occurs outdoors, the victim is generally thrown to the ground and her outer garments stained and soiled. Questions may reasonably be raised concerning the validity of rape charges in which none or only a few of the above manifestations exist." Archambault knew that was wrong. Utterly, spectacularly wrong. She believed that police departments didn't attach enough importance to solving sex crimes. They didn't give investigators enough training or resources. The police's priorities reflected the public's. People outside of law enforcement didn't want to talk about sexual assault. The public wanted the police to concentrate on gangs and murder. The online course she helped create cautions that some victims confuse fine points of their story or even recant. Police, the course material says, should not get lost in stereotypes, believing, for example, that an adolescent victim will be less credible than an adult. To interrogate the victim is totally inappropriate, nor should police use or threaten to use a polygraph device. That can destroy the victim's trust in law enforcement. Plus, a lie detector test is known to be unreliable when used with people experiencing crisis. Archambault has witnessed the impulses that can lead an investigation astray. During training, she plays a 911 tape of a woman saying she was just raped in her apartment. In the apartment's background, a stereo blares. The rapist tied her up, the woman says, over the music. When they hear this tape, police officers in Archambault